this computer, and we're away. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Derek Arden's web chat show. Today, I'm delighted to have Peter Thompson with me. Peter and I have known each other for 20 odd years, and I first appeared on this fantastic program that Peter had, I'm waving it about there, called The Achiever's Edge. Now, I know some of you won't even know what a cassette tape is, but this Achiever's Edge went on for a long time, and I think Peter is still running it, and I know some of you still subscribe. It went over to CD, then it went over to MP4, and I don't know what it's gone over to next. But let me tell you about Peter. Peter's a serial entrepreneur. I'm a banker or a guy that tries things out, but Peter is a serial entrepreneur. Having sold his business for £4.2 million 25 years ago, he then went into the personal development business with the Achiever's Edge and all sorts of really high quality material like that. I met Peter early on in my new career, and I said to him, "How do you write a book, Peter?" And he said, "I'll show you." And I said, "Why don't we write one together?" And we wrote this book, 117 Handy Haggling Hints. I sat in Peter's office in Leamington Spa, having been beaten at golf by him yet again. I always let him win, actually. That was a secret of mine to get him to give me information. And we wrote this. And there's a tip in here which Andy Walker reminded me of only last week, and he credited me with it. And I had to be honest and say it was down to Peter Thompson. And it was that one: if you don't ask, they can't say yes. And as Andy reminded me, not only is that asking, but that is actually being positive and forcing a yes on it. So welcome, everybody. Peter, thanks so much for joining me yet again today. I've got a lot of questions, a lot of things I'd like to get through. So over to you with the first thing. And my first question is, what got you into the personal development business?
Wow, a great question. I can tell you, actually. I was running my business, Compass Leasing, and I got a piece of direct mail through the post from Nightingale Conan, the world's leading audio training company, based in Chicago and based in Paignton. There's a nice mixture of places, isn't it? And this was a promotion for their lead program called Lead the Field by Earl Nightingale. And I could send for it free of charge and only pay for it if I liked it within a month. And I thought, well, it'd be stupid not to. So I sent for it, I got it, I listened to it. And as you know, people use this expression very glibly, but truly changed my life. And I became an absolutely audio junkie. And I started getting loads of programs, listening to them, applying them, teaching to my team. We used to train our sales force every Monday morning from 8 o'clock till lunchtime. And it was all the material that I'd learned. I'd been an avid book reader, but then I got into audio programs. And then using those ideas, as you mentioned, I sold the business, which was great, retired for a little while, and then sat down one day and said, what should I do with myself now? And what I love to do is to share my ideas. And so I went to Nightingale Conant and said, look, I've made this program called Action is the Key. How do you fancy promoting it for me? And they said, yeah, we like it, but would you start off by revoicing Lead the Field for the UK market for us? And so I revoiced the program that had started it all, and it went from there. So that's how I got into it.
Fantastic. And you never stopped, have you?
No. I've just been filming.
That's the problem with Zoom, isn't it? We both can't talk at the same time.
I'll put my hand up.
What started the Achiever's Edge? Because that is, I think, what a lot of people in the personal development business know more than anything. And you've interviewed some fabulous people.
Yeah, I did. What started it was that I was David Hughes, who ran Nightingale Conant in the UK, said to me, he'd been on a seminar in Los Angeles with Jay Abraham, who nobody knew about in those days. And he said, I've seen this guy, Peter, and you really should go. He walks this fine line between genius and madness. And so I said, oh, tell me about it. So he told me, and it was $5,000 a head, this seminar. This is 25 years ago, nearly. $5,000 a head. And I said, how long is it, a year? He said, no, it's 3 days. 3 days, $5,000. I said, because a long time ago. Anyway, I went. I knew somebody, and knowing you, Derek, I negotiated and got him for nothing.
Top man.
But nevertheless, there were 200 people in the room. That was a $1 million seminar. And Jay reminded me, because I'd learnt them before from Ted Nicholas as well and other people, of the three golden questions of business growth, which are basically, How do we increase the number of customers, clients, or patients? How do we increase the average order value? And how do we increase the average order frequency? And when I was thinking about how can I increase the average order frequency of purchase of the people I was dealing with, I thought, well, they're buying an audio program, either from me or from Nightingale Conant, but then that's the end of it. I've got to go back and sell another one or ask them to buy another one. And I thought, well, if I took each of the cassettes out and did it over a 6-month program, I could supply each one of the cassettes on a monthly basis for 6 months. At least I'd get 6 months' money. And I thought, no, actually, there's a better way. What about if I did a fresh cassette every month? And it was on a what we call till for bid program. In other words, you can cancel when you like. So you can stay for a month or 10 years, whatever you want to do. So it's on till for bid, it's an American expression. So I launched the Achiever's Edge. And being bold and entrepreneurial, I went out in the mail with 20,000 bits of mail on an eight-page mail I'd written. And I must have just hit the market right because we've got 5.61% response, which made about, I don't know, in that year, made about 200,000, I suppose, something like that. And so all I did was invest the money in more mailing. So I just used to mail 20,000 bits of mail all the time. And we got up to about 3,000 subscribers. We averaged 1,500 subscribers for 13 years. And it's still going today in its latest iteration, which is now a monthly webinar. It's now called the Achievers Club instead of the Achievers Edge. And so it's got a portal area where I've stored all the material I've created over the years and the 173 interviews I've done, you mentioned those. And I do a monthly live webinar with the members and it's still going strong and I absolutely love it. I think having a subscription program, whether it's a subscription or membership, and obviously they're different, membership and subscription, is just a cracking idea. It helps you help your clients more and it gives you that certainty of income. So when we get turbulent times like we have at the moment, your income doesn't change. The money still comes in at the start of every month. You always get paid before you do the work.
Fantastic. Now, I know that you interviewed some real rock stars on that program. And I had Patricia Fripp on Monday night, and she's a rock star. But the other rock stars I know that I'm really interested in are Richard Bandler and Bob Giordini. Can you talk about those two interviews?
Yes, you did. In fact, I'll start by telling you that the best one that I thought was out of all 173 was Roy H. Williams, who is, you may not know him, but he's known as the Wizard of Ads. He's based in Texas. The guy's an absolute genius when it comes to marketing. And he taught me something that changed the way I did business. And he taught me the difference between the relational client and the transactional customer. Would you like me to share that first?
Yes, please. And Tim, by the way, is saying he knows him.
Oh, Tim, really? Oh, right, great. Yeah, he's great, isn't he, Tim? Absolutely phenomenal. Yeah, brilliant.
Tim's me.
He's absolutely wonderful. I hope everybody looks at the Wizard Academy. Indeed. He's going into semi-retirement, but I'll have more to say about it later, Peter, if anyone is interested.
Yeah, he's
fabulous.
I get Monday messaged him, and it's just genius stuff. Absolutely, I learn every week from him because I'm like a lifelong learner like we are.
Yeah, they're brilliant. Brilliant.
They are, yeah. And he's what he taught me. I did a 40-minute interview with him. It was the best interview I've done. Because of him, not because of me. And he told me this. He said, Peter, he actually never called me Peter because being American, he always calls me Peter, right? But he said to me, Peter, here's the difference. The transactional customer is their own expert and buys on price. The relational client looks for you to be the expert and price is a factor, not the factor. And when I thought about that and I really understood it, I realized that in my business, I only wish to attract relational clients. I'm not interested in dealing with anybody where money is the issue. If they either haven't got the money or they want to negotiate the price, I am not interested. You cannot negotiate for a day of my life. It doesn't work, right? Because I can't replace it. So I only ever look for relational clients and therefore, I don't really have any price challenges. I'm not saying none, but it's positioned properly. And it also then makes us think, well, we've got to walk like an expert, talk like an expert if we are taking that expert stance. So therefore, you've got to have a book because all experts without exception have a book that puts us in the marketplace. So that was the key lesson for me. So many more lessons in that 40 minutes. Probably the best 40 minutes of learning I've ever had on a one-to-one basis. The guy's an absolute genius and a gentleman. I love him to bits. Really nice guy to deal with. But you mentioned the other two. So who did you mention, sorry?
Well, let's start off with Richard Bandler on NLP, because I think I remember that interview. I think you were in a room and there was a band playing next door.
It was. I went round to see the band and I had to tell them a little white lie. I said, look, I'm broadcasting live. Could you just give me 20 minutes, guys, and I'll be all right. Anyway, they did. It was the hardest interview I'd ever done. I think it was set up badly. It was my fault. And I breeze in there to see Dr. Richard Bandler, the co-originator of NLP. And of course, the way I am, Derek, I've gone in, hi, Richard, how you doing? You know, and I think he was expecting me to come in with a little bit more bowing and scraping, which isn't my style. But nevertheless, I got some great information from him, but he would never use my name in the interview. And what you want with an interview, you want someone to use your name at least once, even if they say, Peter, that was a terrible question. You don't mind as long as they do it occasionally. Anyway, never did. So right at the end of the interview, I wanted just to get him to say the word Peter on tape because I could edit it out and move it where I wanted it to be. And because, of course, you can treat edit like written words, as you know. And so I said to him, Richard, if you were going to use somebody's name in the response to a question, would you put their name at the front in the sense of Peter, that's a good question? Would you put it in the middle? That's a good question, Peter, or that is Peter, a good question. Or you stick it at the end, which would you do? And of course, he knew exactly what I was doing. So he looked me in the eye and went, I wouldn't. So he was a real character. And then the other one, Bob Cialdini, Professor Robert Cialdini. Great book. In fact, I've got it here. If you haven't read this book, this is one of my all-time favorites. It's not my top book, but it's one of my favorite books, which is this one of the originals, Influence, Science and Practice. This is a cracker of a book. Derek's got his. I think he's got the red copy.
We had talked about the six traits of influence on a previous program, but there's no harm in ever talking about it again and again and again.
Well, actually, there's nine now because he's increased them along the period. So he talked about the six. He used to call them weapons of influence. He now calls them factors. Into that, he's taken away that sort of confrontational feel of it.
I think that was 9/11, actually. I think that was the story, anyway.
Was it? Okay, that he moved it. So he said you've got to be an authority figure if you're going to be good at this. And there's three factors in authority, which is title, trappings, and clothing. So you've got to get your title right. And I think you've got to have a strap line as well. I think it's really important having a strap line. Trappings, everything is trappings. And clothing, to be well-dressed, is to be appropriately dressed, as we know. And the one I think that is misunderstood of Cialdini's, which I think is one of the really powerful ones, is when he talks about commitment, consistency. And I think it gets glossed over a bit because I find that is so powerful and links into NLP because of labeling. So the way I phrase it is people will tend to remain consistent to non-forced, publicly announced previous commitments. And so if you can find out how somebody has labeled themselves, they've written this label out and stuck it on their forehead, and you can, with integrity, position what it is that you have for them, whatever service it is or product you have, that is matches the label. In other words, it's consistent with their previously made commitments. Then they're far more likely to want to be engaged with you or by or whatever the situation is. And Cialdini in this book tells this brilliant account of the fact that some researchers went around in California with this ugly sign, big ugly sign, 8-foot by 4-foot sign about driving safely, and asked people to put it in their front garden. And it was a badly done sign. And amazingly, 17% of those people said they would. I mean, I think in the UK, there would have been a fight, be a terrible thing. And then they did another thing where they got much higher compliance, which was 2 weeks before, some researchers went around with a 3-inch by 2-inch sign, right, and said, will you put this in your front window? And it was a driving campaign. And of course, the vast majority of people said yes and put it in there. They went back to the people who put the sign in the front windows, and obviously they could see the sign, just 2 weeks later, and asked if they would put the big sign in their place as well. And I think I've got it here, after remember, yeah. 76% of those people who put the little sign in agreed to put the big sign in later. Why? Because it was a non-forced, previously made commitment, and they remained consistent with that. So there was that bit there. And with his latest work, Bob Cialdini has added a ninth to things that used to be eight, which is all about family. And I've been using this for a long, long, long time, and everybody told me I was wrong, and I'm not a smart aleck here. But on a web page where you used to have a landing page and you ask people for their name and their email, I used to ask people for their name, their email, and their phone number. And people said to me, you're crazy, you'll reduce your response rates. And I said, no. I'll increase the response rates of the people I want to deal with, right? Which is a different thing. And so what I was doing was, I was using this family idea in the sense of Cialdini talks about trust. And trust, when it comes to persuasion, is what is it that you would do for a member of your family? And if you will do that for me, I know that our relationship is working well. And it's probably working well in the sense of it's relational rather than transactional. And so I would ask people for their phone numbers on squeeze pages, landing pages. And we would find that about 80% of people would put their information in there, the phone number. And about 80% of the numbers were accurate. Some people just put in random numbers just to get through the next part. So 80% of 80 is about 60-odd%, 64. So let's call that 2/3 of people were actually giving me their phone numbers, their accurate phone numbers, and very often their mobile numbers. And you can imagine how powerful that is if you have a marketing system or process, part of which is determining that you're going to phone those people or somebody's going to phone them on your behalf, make an appointment. If you've got 2/3 of the people giving you the phone number, just think of the level of trust that they're demonstrating on the first occasion. They've read your material and straight away they're prepared to give you their phone number. I mean, that talk about trust. That's a family thing. That's the ninth thing that Cialdini taught me. And really interesting stuff, all of the stuff that he talks about, scarcity, social proof, reciprocation, and all the rest of it. I know with my, I've written books, as you know, all my life and made audio programs, hundreds and hundreds of audio programs. I've been filming today my TGI Mondays message, and I've just filmed number 898 today. So I've been doing it for 17 years and 12 weeks in a row, right? So I just do churn this stuff out all the time, you know, good quality material. And at Cialdini was just taught me so much stuff by listening to this man. So I, if you haven't read this book, I would say this is a wise investment, Influence, Science and Practice, or anything from Cialdini. The guy's a really nice guy.
Guys, and Peter, I would say that, and if you haven't read Win-Win by Derek Arden, there's a chapter in there about how you can use Cialdini for your negotiations, et cetera. Peter, I've got to talk about authority for a minute, because I know a story you told me, and Will's heard this. I'm not sure if you were spinning it or it was true, but you had a gardener that was your chauffeur, I think.
I did.
And I seem to remember when you were speaking at a conference when you were pitching to people, he would walk in with his chauffeur's uniform on and his hat and place your papers at the front before you arrived. Did you really do that?
He did indeed. That was positioning. In fact, when I used to go shopping, he used to walk one pace behind me. And we used to do it just for the crack. I mean, we weren't being flash. We just did it for the laugh. And he was great. I remember we once stopped years ago. I used to smoke. I don't smoke, but I used to smoke. And he stopped at the shop to get some cigars or something. And somebody, I was sitting at the back of the car, and somebody said to him in the shop, "Well, who's that in the car?" And he said, "Just some aging rock star." Oh, we used to have a lot of fun. He used to go shopping with my wife, and he used to push the trolley with his hat. He used to have his hat on, and he used to walk behind with the trolley. I mean, we just used to do it just for having fun, you know.
But he's got more front than Sainsbury's. I've always said that.
I know.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah.
Well, it's back to what Andy was saying, wasn't it? If you don't ask, they can't say yes.
Absolutely. I want to come back, if we've got time, to one or two of the other people you've interviewed. But one of the stories that's resonated with me for life, and you tell it so brilliantly, is the Mexican fisherman, because I think we're all Mexican fishermen. Could you tell that story without any prompting?
Yeah, I can. I remember it. Actually, I think I was originally told it was the Mexican boatman. He's a fisherman, but you're right. So the way I heard it was this, and I've got a take on it at the back end. I'll tell the brief version of it. There was a Mexican boatman doing his stuff. But on the same beach was a guy who was a Harvard MBA. And he was there on holiday. And he happened to notice this Mexican boatman. He went over and had a chat to him. And he said, "I'm really interested. Tell me about your life." And the guy said, "Well, it's a fairly simple life." He said, "I get up early in the morning and I go out in the boat and I aim to catch one yellowfin tuna, which is this great big massive big thing. And I bring it back and I take it down to the market and I sell it. And then I come back and I have some food with my family. I have a bit of a sleep because I was up really early. in the evening, I would go down to the local taverna. He said, I play guitar, I sing with my friend, have a couple of beers. And then the next day, I get up and do it again. And the Harvard MBA says, oh, that's fantastic. He said, I think I might be able to help you. And the guy says, well, tell me. He said, well, look, this is what we could do. If are there other people like you in the village that also do what you do? He said, yes. He said, great. He said, we'll form this little cooperative. And what we'll do is we'll sell the fish rather than to the market. We'll actually sell it directly to the canner. And we'll get more money for it because we'll cut out the middleman. But over time, we'll actually have our own canning business and we'll build it up and we'll build it up. And eventually, we will actually take it to the stock exchange and we'll do an IPO with it. And we'll make a chunk of money. And the guy said, well, how much money will I make? He said, well, you personally, you'll probably make about $20 million. He said, wow, that's amazing. He said, how long will it take? He said, about 20 years. He said, well, pretty good return. He said, I like it. Yeah, fantastic. He said, what do I do next? He said, oh, that's the best bit. He said, you retire to a little Mexican fishing village. And in the morning, you get up early, you go out in the boat on your own, you catch one yellow. And I heard that story and I went, you know, I thought that my life was on a straight line. And I realized for some of it, not all of it, for some of it, it was actually on a circle. And what I was trying to achieve was what I'd already achieved, but what I wasn't doing was enjoying the success enough. So it made me reflect and say, hang on a minute, Peter, what is it in your life that is, you've already achieved that bit that you wanted to? And I've had some amazing success, but I've had some phenomenal failures as well. You know, I love failing. I've learned some stuff. And I realized that I had to stop chasing some of the goals, reassess and say, start living some of the goals. And so for me, it was a fabulous personal development story.
Absolutely brilliant, that one. And it's very similar to the Acres of Diamonds. And if anyone hasn't seen that, just Google the Acres of Diamonds and that story comes up the same. Yes, Peter.
I can do that for you quickly.
Okay. Go on then.
So there was a man called Russell Conwell who was responsible for building Temple University in America, which was a university that was built to enable young men and women who couldn't afford to go to college and university to actually get a university degree. And the way he raised the money was he told this story more than 6,000 times across America and raised money for telling it. And the story goes as follows, that he was on a trip throughout Africa and the local guide who was taking him was full of stories. But there was this one particular one that reserved for his particular friends. And this is the way it went. And he said, there's this man called Ali Hafid. And Ali Hafid was a wealthy and contented man. He was wealthy because he was contented. He was contented because he thought he was wealthy. And one day on his farm where he lived, a priest came and started chatting to him and started to tell him about the beginnings of the world and how God had put his finger into this swirling mass of stuff. And as it went through the universe, spinning on its way, it started to cool. And the early stuff that came out of the cooling were the base metals and onwards and upwards and the precious metals. And finally, what came out at the end after all the worlds were finished was a drop of sunlight, which was a diamond. And he told Ali Hafid, he said, if you had diamonds the size of your thumb, you could put all of your children on the thrones of all the world. And that night, Ali Hafid went to bed, a poor and discontented man. Poor because he was discontented and discontented because he thought he was poor now because he hadn't got the diamonds. So he sold his farm and he went off in search of diamonds. He started in the mountains of the moon and he went off and all the way throughout Africa. And in the end, wretched, having not found them, he took his own life in the Bay of Barcelona. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the guy that owned now the ranch was going across it, and he happened to notice in a little stream a glint. And he looked down, it was a nice black stone, quite a sizable thing, and he picked it up, and he brought it back, and he put it on his mantelpiece. Thought nothing more of it. You know where this is going. A few months later, the priest came back and came in, and he happened to see through the doorway the stone on the mantelpiece. And he said, oh, Ali Hafid's come back. And he said, no, we have heard nothing of him. We don't know what's happened to him. They said, no, but the diamond. He said, no, it's just a stone that was in the stream on the property. He said, no, let me, that, I think it's a diamond. Anyway, as you might imagine, it was a diamond. And it happened to be that Ali Hafid had sold a farm that had acres of diamonds because he didn't bother to find out what they looked like or where you could find them. And that particular mine was the Golconda mine, where the Orlov jewels, which is the Russian royal jewels, and the Kohinoor diamond from the British royal family came from, one of the most profitable diamond mines in the world. And obviously the moral of the story is that it reminds us, particularly about our own client list, to have a look at our own acres of diamonds and see what we're already standing in rather than go and search for them somewhere else.
That is just so true. And we do need to take out a bit of time for reflection, as we've been talking about on this program. Review, reflect, and reset what you're doing after these extraordinary times that we are in. Peter, we've got a few questions in the chat box, but I just wanted to talk about one thing before I ask you them. I remember, and you were talking about funny money there, and when we wrote this, you introduced me to the word verisimilitude.
I did.
Because I teach, preach, and try and get people to realize that they should price in funny money, because funny money has the looks like it's right. So when you reduce your price and someone asks you for a discount, you don't come down 10%, you come down 9.3% or whatever the number is. A, you save some money, and B, they believe you. You've got a better take on that. I think it comes from a novel, doesn't it? Frederick Forsyth, am I right?
It actually comes from, the first time I came across the word was when I was reading The Day of the Jackal, where the jackal goes to see Mr. Huysens, the Belgian gunmaker, and he wants the gun made, and he wants to have it fitted in the aluminium crutch, and he said it must have verisimilitude. And I thought, don't know what the word is, so I looked it up. This is years and years ago, and it means having the appearance of truth. So it's a great word. And there's another one we use in English, but it comes from the French, which is vraisemblance, which means the same thing, having the appearance of truth. And then when I interviewed Ted Nicholas, you mentioned about interviews, Ted Nicholas said to me, there's a very powerful word in marketing, you probably don't know it. And I said, what is it? He said, verisimilitude. And I, of course, being a smart aleck, said, oh, you mean having the appearance of truth? And he said, yes, it's far better in your marketing to say 9,362 people have tried this and these are some of the testimonials than to say about 10,000 people have bought it. It's that those specificity of numbers is really powerful in marketing and in negotiation, as you mentioned there, Derek, which is great. Just a little side point here. Now, the word discount is not a relational word. It's only a transactional word. So if you're aiming to be having a relationship with people, I think you should remove the word discount from your language, because I don't think it works personally.
Peter, a question from Gabby. What's the difference between subscription and membership?
Right. I think that most people, Gabby, and I think you probably know the answer to this as well, is that with membership, there's almost this feeling of care, that people are far more connected. That is, you want, excuse me a second, I've just got a tickle. I'll just stop my microphone for a second. Excuse me, sorry. Sorry, didn't want to cough in your ear. I think with membership, it's a closer relationship. A subscription is like, let's say you subscribe to Amazon Prime. And by the way, I don't know if you know that the average Amazon Prime member spends $1,400 a year in whatever currency. The average non-Prime member spends $600 a year. That's why Amazon pushed to get you on Prime, right? So once you're a subscriber, so you can think of Amazon being a subscription. If you think of Netflix, it's a subscription. But if you think of some of the closer things you've got, let's say tennis, golf, personal development, you tend to be a member, right? PSA, you're a member. You're not a subscriber, you're a member. So it's that difference in that closeness and the care of the provider to get you the outcome that you want. It's almost like one's a push strategy and one's a pull strategy. So as a Netflix subscriber, I pull the information when I want it. Yeah, there's loads there, it's a portal, and I can pull what I want. But if I'm a member of something, that person is pushing the information towards me to help me in a greater way. Did that make some sort of sense, Gabby? Yeah?
Yes, absolutely. And interesting that the membership is that sense of belonging as well.
That's the word. Yeah. Sorry, I missed that word out. You're absolutely right. The word is belonging. I don't belong to Netflix. I'm a subscriber too, but I belong. When I used to play golf, I don't play golf anymore. I used to belong to the golf course. So that is exactly what you're saying. It's that sense of belonging. I must remember, that's a great word to add into that.
I just wanted to get your take on the difference, because you referred to it.
Indeed. I have membership programs and I have subscription. All my income is based on subscription, in the sense of, even though they're membership programs, we call it subscription. Even my private client work, I don't do one-off stuff. It's only ever on a subscription basis. However short it is, 3 months, 6 months, whatever it might be, but it's always a program of work. I won't do one-off stuff. I'm not interested. I'm very relational, you know. My team, I've only got a very small team. There's only six of us. We've worked together for 35 years, right? So, you know, we are relational. That's the way we work it, you know.
And interesting that you've talked about the transactional and relational. That for me is also the difference between the subscription and a membership.
Precisely. In fact, we could have summed it up with that, couldn't we? Say subscription is transactional, membership is relational. I think that would be a lovely link to the two. Yeah, I like that very much.
I think membership is really powerful. I hadn't really thought about that, but I'm going to think about it, have a little reflect on that, very much so. Kevin from Chicago asks, what is the preferred relational word rather than a transactional discount?
Well, I would never discount anything. I would alter the deal. I would add value to it. I'd find a different name for it. I'd just remove the word and the concept of discounting totally. I just hate the idea of discounting. I remember saying to a client years ago, and I did say it with a smile. He took a slight affront to it, but we still remain very good friends. And I said to him jokingly, I said, if you know a shop where I can go and buy another day of my life, then I'll happily talk about the price. Until I can find that shop, I'm sorry, this is my day rate. That's the end of it, you know. But you gather I'm high D if you've done disc profiling, so you gather what I'm like. But it was my stance on it, because I think we have to, when we're in the sort of businesses that we're in, we have to have a stance. We have to have an opinion in the marketplace. We can't be grey. We've got to be, you know, this is my way. It doesn't mean that you push people away at all. Although a lot of marketing is actually, and should, I believe, be designed to push away the wrong people and attract the right people. So much marketing I see so bland, trying to attract everybody. You know, I don't want to attract everybody. I'm very clear on who my avatar that I would talk to is, and that's the only people I want to talk to. Why? Because my choice, you know.
You're very, very focused, Peter, aren't you? I don't know what high D means, but I saw people nodding. They all do. So.
They all know what it means. I'm surprised I haven't got a pink shirt on because I'm high DI.
Ted Nicholas, you mentioned, I saw he passed away a few years ago. You talked about him a lot. I know there was 27 key sales words, weren't there, or something from Ted Nicholas, if I remember correctly. Can you just give us a few of those before I open up the chat box?
Most definitely. A couple of really cracking bits, actually. Number one, the top word in marketing is the word free. You will never get away from, I don't think. The word free attracts people.
Can I just ask you one question on that, though? Because doesn't free get spammed out by Google and, you know?
It does. But if you're going to put it in the subject line of an email, it's all right in the body copy. And, of course, you can make the word free a picture. So it appears as a picture in the email. So it isn't read as a word if you wanted that. But the way I would do it is I would spell free, FR33.
Okay.
FR33 looks like free, but actually is not spotted by spam filters. Because I'm not trying to con anybody with it. I'm just saying it is free. This is the thing, though. There are different levels of free. If we talk marketing for a moment. If you're going to give somebody, let's say, a free report, I would say you've got to put the price on the report. Because otherwise it's a free report and it has no value. But if you put a price on it and then you give it away free, then that has some value. And that's different. That's a different psychology. So if you created a report or a book or whatever it might be, this is my latest book. Here you go. How to write your business book in 5 days or less. Yeah. So because books these days are getting smaller and smaller to get higher and higher readership. The research out of the States, Tim, I don't know if you know about this, you might know about this, is that if your book is 60 to 80 pages, you'll get 80 to 100% readership. As soon as it hits 100 pages, readership can drop to 3%. And at 200 pages, it drops to 1% unless it's niche. If it's niche, all the rules go out the window, obviously, right? So I think that's really important. So I have a price on this. It says value, priceless. Cost just a tenner. That's what it says on the back, right? So, because I'm just trying to make it slightly different from the marketplace. So I think it's ideal that we should have a book. I think, you know, I've gone off track here, but I think it's absolutely right. And so, Tim, I saw your thumbs up. Thanks very much indeed. Right. Actually, just for a second, Derek, because a lot of us are using Zoom, let me just show you something I think will amuse us. if we're talking about back, I'm going to change my background for a minute to this one. This is a background I use, okay? Particularly when I'm talking about climbing mountains. Not that I climb mountains, but I use it as a metaphor. But you know that in Zoom these days, you can use what's called reactions. And you can have clapping, can't you? And you can have, you can have thumbs up and things like that. Actually, there's a better way to do it, actually. So I'll wait till the thumbs up disappears for a second. And I'll show you a different version. Okay. Go away. Okay. Here's mine. Ha! You see, there's a better thumbs up, isn't it? That's better than Zoom's thumbs up. Okay. And I bet that this one, I'll do this one. I do this one when I'm doing stuff just for fun, you know. And so people say to me, well, where's that in Zoom? Well, of course it isn't. So I'll tell you how to do it because people don't know how to do this and it's so simple. All I've done is I've got three backgrounds. I've got this background, which is this one. I've got this background, which is this one, and this one, this one. But it doesn't look as though I've changed the background. It just looks as though I'm throwing that bit on. In fact, I've just changed the whole background. That's what I did with that. So that was a bit of a laugh, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was. You're always up to things like that. But keep them coming because we love this. We love these ideas. They're brilliant. No, we don't want to see Kintish up there like that, do we?
No, we don't. Well, you can use your branding, of course, yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Well, I actually don't. This is what I do. You know, people talk about you've got to share your screen and all the rest of it, which I do. I know how to do. I tell you what I find is easier.
Yeah.
Just print the slides out. This is my email. If you'd like a free copy of this book, you can have it. Just go to this address. You see, there's no P in my surname. Just go to peterthompson.com and you can either download it or you can send for it for a bit of post and packet. So I find that's a much easier promotion than that. I was doing one today with a voucher. So I did this. And that's why, if you notice, I'm not sitting in the middle of the screen. Right? Yeah. So I always sit off to the side on the thirds. You can see I've actually put the lines on, so you can tell. I'm actually sat on the thirds, and then I can put this on the other third there.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And of course, I've read that makes it much more personal. It makes it much more like you're ad-libbing rather than just pulled a few PowerPoint slides out from your usual presentation.
Yes, absolutely right. It's all of those bits that make it work. Yeah. So
Peter, we're running out of time. I would like you just, there's time for one or two questions when I unmute people, but the story of the bird being taken to the edge and taking action is one of my favorites. And you used to use that when you closed the Achiever's Edge. Can you still remember it?
I can. In fact, it was written by Christopher Logue, L-O-G-U-E. I used to think it was written by William Apollinaire, but in fact, it was a comment on a poster about William Apollinaire, and it actually wasn't him that wrote it. It was Christopher Logue, who's a British guy. And it's supposedly, and I'm probably a bit of poetic license here, the mother eagle talking to her chicks, and it goes like this. Come to the edge, she said. We might fall. Come to the edge. It's too high. Come to the edge. They came, she pushed them, and they flew. And the bit I normally add in is, but not all of them. Some fell over and broke their necks, but that's life.
You've added that in recently. You didn't on the Achiever's Edge, because I have a feeling you were pitching and selling as you do subliminally, which we noticed, of course, but we'll all be copying that idea, I'm sure. Peter, that was absolutely brilliant, and thank you. And you used to say at the end of the Achiever's Edge, here's one last idea for you. And what would your idea be for us?
I would say this. I would say that it's important that to be successful, as Earl Nightingale taught me on Lead the Field, we have to be constructively discontent. So we haven't got to be moaners like so many people in the world who are just discontent, or in fact, we could call them discontents, plural. But we have to be constructively discontent, and we have to say, I'm not happy with this thing that's happening. My earnings, my life, my whatever it is, you know, to recognize that there's a part of life we're not comfortable with, but that we're prepared to do something about it. And then the stage two, I believe, of being successful is then to commit. But there's a problem with commitment. And commitment makes you feel awful. Why? Because commitment triggers courage, and courage comes with butterflies. And so the moment you commit, part of you goes, oops, Should I really? It's like committing to stand and speak somewhere. Suddenly that little bit of stage fright kicks in, right? So it's part of the process, because that's what courage feels like. Courage doesn't feel bold. Courage feels frightening. And that's what it is. It frightens you, which is great, because then you absolutely commit and you say that. Then you simply decide which bits you're going to do and which bits you're going to get someone else to do, because people will never consistently do who they aren't. So just do the stuff you can do. So John Harvey Jones said to me when I interviewed him, Peter, only ever do what only you can do. Leave the rest to everybody else. That's what they're supposed to be doing. And then the next bit, the last bit, is to take action. After all, action is the key. There you go.
Fabulous. Peter Thompson, you've been an absolute delight, and thank you so much for joining us. Just one question in the chat box, which I must ask you, from Kevin in Chicago. Did you ever meet Earl Nightingale?
No, I didn't. I met Vic Conant. I'd got to know Vic very well, and Kevin McNeely, who ran it. Unfortunately, Kevin died fairly, about 3 years ago. But he died before I was connected. I have listened to most of his stuff. I think the guy, just fantastic. Absolutely fabulous.
Peter, I'm going to stop the recording now, but if you wouldn't mind joining us for a few private questions when I unmute, and that the people will miss if they're on YouTube, but if they joined our programs, they would get the real secrets. Peter Thompson, thank you very much indeed.
It's my pleasure. Absolutely. Love to do it. Love to be with you all. Thank you.